I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from iHeartRadio.
Everyone must have some thought that's gonna pull them through somehow. While the fires are raging hotter and hotter, but the sisters of the sun are gonna rock me on the water now. Rock me on the water, sister, will you soothe my fever brow?
Jackson Browne released his self-titled debut album and this song, Rock Me on the Water, in early 1972, when he was just 23 years old. At that point, he'd already been writing songs professionally for 7 years. Part of that time he spent in the heyday of New York City's folk scene. He'd written songs for the likes of Joan Baez, Linda Ronstadt, The Byrds, Greg Allman, and Nico. In 1968, Browne moved back to Los Angeles and set his course to become one of the greatest singer-songwriters of his generation. Known for his political activism and his honest, self-reflective lyrics, Jackson Browne's 14 studio albums have sold over 18 million copies. Bruce Springsteen inducted him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2004. Jackson Browne comes from a family of musicians, journalists, and dreamers. His grandfather spent a decade building a stone house in Highland Park, Los Angeles, complete with a huge pipe organ in the basement.
My father played organ in silent movies, actually.
No.
Yeah, and there was a pipe organ in the house that I grew up in. It was in the chapel, and it was built by the Angelus Organ Company. I mean, I personally broke the organ when I was a kid because you could go behind the pipes and play around. It was like a secret passageway, but I must have put my foot through something, a bellows or something.
Your grandfather and your father played the organ. You broke the organ.
Yes.
I just want to be very clear about that.
Yes.
Now, you know, I was reading about you. I mean, obviously, I knew something about you, and I knew a lot about the songs you've written, but I didn't know about your earliest life, where when you were very young, you left to go to New York, where you were right out of high school. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Now, why? What was the calling to go to New York?
You know, the music I was listening to was all coming from Cambridge and Greenwich Village, you know, the folk meccas were those two places on the East Coast. And even though folk music was from all over the country, the people who were doing it were coming out of New York. And I would meet players that were playing in, say, Huntington Beach, you know, and they were from New York. And I just wanted to go. But my friends invited me to go to drive with them to New York. It took us 3 1/4 days. We just drove straight from L.A. to New York with three guys sharing the gas. And there I was in New York in the snow with my penny loafers and my T-shirt. You know, it's like...
You're a Californian by birth.
Not really. I was born in Germany, but my grandfather came to California when he was young, and so my family's from California.
You went from Germany to California when you were how old?
Three.
Who were some of the people that were influences you in terms of folk music?
Well, Joan Baez, and then Bob Dylan. Of course, he played a lot of folk music as well as, you know, writing songs. And Kerner, Ray, and Glover, and they made a record called Blues Records and Hollers. And I like the blues. I listen to a lot of blues records. And that's what I mean also when I say folk music. I mean folk, you know, country blues and Mississippi John Hurt and, you know, Doc Watson and all these, you know, both white and black country musicians.
And when you went to New York, what was that like? Where did it start for you there? You were writing music with who and where?
I was writing my own songs, but I wasn't really writing with anybody there. I wasn't there for very long, 3 or 4 months. Tim Buckley was playing at this club in the Village, and he was sort of sharing the bill with an artist named Nico. And it was Andy Warhol's sort of bar that he set up to, you know, do installations. And anyway, Tim told me Nico was looking for an accompanist, so I got the job doing that. Except Andy didn't want it to seem like folk music, and they wanted her to sing from inside of a plexiglass box. She didn't want to do that. She was not really trying to be a spectacle. She was trying to be a musician. So anyway, that's really all that happened. I lived on the Lower East Side with a friend of mine that was doing his conscientious objector alternate service by working in Head Start. And we lived down like Clinton and Delancey. But I was only there for a few months. You know?
Why? Was New York not for you?
I got kind of homesick, yeah. I've thought many times about what I might have done had I stayed there, you know. One of the things that happened was I got robbed buying clothes. I had like been paid and I had a bunch of money and I wanted to, it was a clothes store that famously Bob Dylan had bought a lot of clothes there and stuff. I went in this place and I left my jacket hanging on a hook in the dressing room and I went to go pay for the clothes I bought and my wallet was gone. And so I didn't buy the clothes and I sort of went home penniless. But about New York, it was interesting to me because people were friendly. I'd been living in Orange County where people were more or less hostile to people that looked like me. And if you were a freak in Orange County, it was hardcore. You had to be, you know.
Committed.
Yeah, committed. Yeah, exactly.
We're in Orange County. What town were you in?
Fullerton. But I lived all over Orange County because friends of mine would get a house at the beach and they'd be living in Huntington or they'd be living in Newport. There were a lot of freaks.
Now, when you leave New York, you go back to L.A. driven by work, music, opportunity, songwriting, or you just want to go home?
Well, I always wanted to record my songs. As a matter of fact, one of the first things that happened when I got back was I was asked by a friend of mine who was in a band. There was a band that I hung around with a lot called The Gentle Soul, and I hung around in their house, and everything was so communal in those days. People just lived together a lot, so anyway, I was invited to audition for that band, and that's where I met Jesse Ed Davis, the great guitar player who played on my first single, Doctor My Eyes. The audition didn't come to anything, and I didn't see how it could because I didn't really know how to be in a band. I wasn't in bands in high school. I just, I was just a songwriter. The other guy I met in that audition was Leroy Marinell, who co-wrote Werewolves of London with Warren Zevon and Waddy Wachtel later. So it was an interesting group of people, but in the end, none of us joined that band.
Doctor My Eyes is your first single you record.
Yeah.
And what's the path to writing songs? Because I'm assuming that there's a period of your young life before you become the Jackson Browne we all know. You weren't performing and you were only writing songs or you were doing both?
Oh, no. I sang in clubs.
Solo?
Yeah, I sang my songs. And I didn't sing so well. Even though I knew a lot of folk songs, I mean, I sang them all the time. I sang blues and folk songs and traditional songs, and especially learned guitar things like Mississippi John Hurt or Dave Van Ronk guitar pieces or Doc Watson. I mean, it was part of a group of people who were crazy about music, and that was the thing that drove everything for me. But as far as playing, I guess I felt that I had the right to sing these songs as I wrote them. Otherwise, who would listen to me sing? As a matter of fact, I remember sitting up singing songs at a party, and this friend of mine, a good friend of mine, sort of gently tried to tell me, look, you know, you play really well, but, you know, you shouldn't try to sing.
Give us the name for the record of the woman who told Jackson Browne, I'd cool it on the singing front if I were you. Who was it that said that to Jackson Browne?
Well, her name was Ruth Ann Kendall.
Ruth Ann, if you're out there, we want to just introduce you to Jackson Browne, who sold 18 million records. Singing. But anyway, when you get back from New York, what's the gap between arriving back in California, wherever you are, and Doctor My Eyes gets pressed? You make a record.
Years.
It was years.
Yeah.
Was it really?
4 or 5 years, yeah. At the time, I was 18, so I made my first record when I was about 22, I guess. So it was about 4 years before I got anything going. But I'd go to the Troubadour and I'd sing on Monday nights in the open mic there. And I would play in little clubs in the beach towns. And I had so much time. It was fantastic. And also, I didn't even have a car for most of that. I finally got a car when I was about 20 or something. I don't know. I was living in Echo Park for a long time without a car. And my best friend just finally got sick of driving there to get me and bring me back to Hollywood. All I did was play and I kind of longed for that.
And how did Doctor My Eyes get made into a record?
Well, that was the one song I had written that was probably up-tempo enough and short enough and simple enough to make it on the radio. And it was understood, I mean, at least I understood that it might not be your best song that gets on the radio, but if it was your shortest, fastest song, it might actually
the right song.
They're really serious about that. The records had to be not more than 3 minutes long. Matter of fact, 2:52 was ideal. And I don't know how you say anything in 2 minutes, but most of my songs were really long, 5 or 6 minutes. And Dark Demise could be made into that kind of a song. And it was, you know, you were kind of obligated to try, but it never occurred to me that it would actually work, that we'd get on, I'd get on the radio.
So you took that song to someone, or someone heard you play it in a club?
No. It was one of my songs, like early on, like for instance, like in New York, I was making demo. I had been signed to a publishing company in high school. So I was given $500 advance. And I was signed away half the song to a record company. Elektra Records had a publishing company called Nina Music. And my best friend not only got signed to that publishing company, but made a record for Elektra. So I was sort of in line to maybe get recorded eventually, you know, if things shaped up. So it's a long and winding road, but there was a record that got made at Elektra, but it wasn't any good and didn't get released. So, okay, so back to singing at the Monday night hoots at the Troubadour. And eventually I did start being managed by David Geffen. And you want to know how that happened? I simply sent him a recording and a photograph. And the recording was of my song, Jamaica Say You Will. And it was a recording made in a kind of a publisher's demo with Glenn Frey singing and playing guitar and me playing piano and John David Souther playing the drums and singing. And those guys sang really great. And so I thought it sounded pretty good. And then eventually I called in to see what was going on. And I was invited to come in and talk with David Geffen. And for those who don't know, David Geffen managed Laura Nero, he managed Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and his partner in his management company managed Neil Young and Joni Mitchell. He's really responsible for making songwriters sort of the focus of music in those at that time. It was already happening, but he was the one in the music business that said, look, I think, you know, this is what really matters. So anyway, so yeah, I met with him and he said, okay, I'll manage you. And I was like, you will? Oh, good. Then really the next thing he said was, you know, we're not in a hurry. You know, well, you're going to work on your singing, and which I was. You know, I mean, it was obvious that I needed to get better. So I spent time doing that. And also he took me around to a lot of record companies. He took me to Elektra, where I'd already been. It was hilarious because there I am sitting in the office of Jack Holzman, whom I know. Yeah. Who had already signed me to his label, and I had, like, you know, asked to be released after they didn't release the album. But I mean, Jack Holzman, he owned the publishing company that owned my music.
Nina
Music. Well, Geffen asked him to, and he did, give me back my publishing. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
No.
It was wild. And to this day, I mean, I'm indebted to him. And he was a kind of exceptional record man. Well, while he built that record company on the back of a Vespa, he literally recorded the artists, he mastered the records, he pressed them, he put them in a box on the back of his Vespa, and he took them to the record stores all over Manhattan.
Good God.
And he built Elektra Records that way. And he was very opinionated about everything, music especially. But so he was kind of a hero to me. And there I was in his office, and he didn't sign me then. Geffen walks in with me. And he didn't think I was there yet. But he also took me to see Clive Davis. He took me to, you know, he asked Ahmet Erdogan to sign me. And none of these people wouldn't. And he decided to open his own record company.
Now, when you, throughout your career, when you're writing music, is there a kind of a sense that there's a Jackson Browne sound?
No. If anything, I thought I had some good songs, and I was really just trying to learn to sing. And also, I had the great, great good fortune to make friends with a drummer named Russell Kunkel. Russ was really cool, and people were nice to me. I mean, one time I ran into Jim Keltner, who was also very cool, and he was a drummer on a session that they were doing. Johnny Rivers was recording one of my songs, and they befriended me. They were very, very kind. So Russ said, just so you know, when you get ready to make your record, whenever that is, I want you to call me. I want to play on your record. So I did. I called the people that I knew and who had been friendly to me. And that's the degree to which I strategized about anything. It's just like, call up somebody you know is a good drummer and, you know, call a friend. I still don't know how to call up somebody I don't know and ask if we can make music together.
You still don't?
I don't know how to do that.
Who's someone you wanted to call? I'm happy to call them for you, by the way. Hello, Bono, it's Alec. Jackson's feeling a little uptight. You said Russ Kunkel.
Russ Kunkel and Lee Sklar played on that record, and they made it sound really... I mean, I listened to it the other day, and, you know, I spent years thinking it was kind of rudimentary and that I was not much of a singer yet, and I was... But really, they really imbued it with a kind of confidence and a kind of... They brought the best out of the songs, and when I hear it now, I think, this is okay. This is pretty good. As a matter of fact, Dr. Myers comes on, I think, well, this is really good. And... by standards that I didn't even have at the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this piano part that starts the song that goes da-dun, 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 da-dun. Well, when I wrote it, I just did that through the whole song. And you, da-dun, da-dun, da-dun. It's like some give me a bouncy C. It was like that kind of just trying to give you the impression that they were drums, you know. So when we got in the studio with the drummer and we said, well, we can't do that, and what shall I do? And I just said, well, I'll do like the Beatles, you know, thump, bump, 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 bump. And, you know, magically... the great musicians I had, Russ and Lee, just made it sound incredible. So the other interesting thing about that song is it was recorded with bass and congas, not drums, and that the drums were overdubbed. And I don't know if anybody listening knows what the difference would be, because mostly congas get added to something in American music, sort of an added element of percussion. But in fact, when there's a conga player in the band and things are based on that groove, when it's like Taking It to the Streets or Little Feat's incredible songs, you know, like it makes a huge difference. It's built into the DNA of the song that there's a swing. You know, Russ was playing this, and it gives it this bounce and this swing that I think now is like, I really value it. At the time I thought, well, we're doing the best we can making this song that's a little bit, it's short. I didn't think it was my best song.
What do you think is your best song? I'm sure it's impossible to pick one.
Oh, well.
But what's one that comes to mind? What's a song when you wrote the song? Well, we're going to get back to that. I'm going to go to another place, which is that because you do downplay your singing early on. And was there a period where, I mean, and you're a famous singer. So if you're insecure about your singing in the early days, were there songs you wrote where you said to yourself, I'm not going to sing this, I'm going to hand it to somebody else? Did you pass it on to somebody else?
Well, lots of people recorded my songs before I did, but it wasn't that I had passed them to them. They do me a favor by recording my songs. I mean, like Tom Rush recorded a song of mine that I still haven't played. I mean, I was a songwriter, and I wouldn't say I was insecure. I just knew very well that I didn't sing well.
Were there songs you wrote that you thought were better sung by someone else?
Yeah, that's always been the case, actually. You know, like Greg Allman's version of These Days. I mean, I recorded that. I didn't put it on my first album, and I'd almost forgotten about the song, and he recorded it. But also, yeah, I got to say, like, that song was recorded by Nico before anybody else recorded it, and I played the guitar part on her record, and she, it was so unique, the sound of her voice and her accent and the fact that in order for her to sing the song and for me to play how I played, I mean, when I wrote it, I had to play it way up the neck and put a capo on the guitar so that it sounded very chimey. And the combination of that chimey guitar part and her wonderful, deep voice and her German accent, you know, it's a very iconic performance. And I think it's more famous, you know, for her, because of her, than it is for me. And a lot of people recorded, though. I mean, Tom Rush, lots of people recorded these days. Glenn Campbell. And funny, when Glenn Campbell recorded, he basically recorded her version of it. So you wanted other people to record your songs.
But so you were similar to Carole King in that way.
Yeah. If I hear myself saying that I was similar to Carole King. Carole King wrote some of the greatest songs of all time when she was a housewife, you know? Yeah, the songwriters wrote at home, you know? And when I met Carole, she told me, I get the kids off to school by 9 o'clock and then I've got a few hours to work. Because we were talking about work habits, you know, because I didn't have any. You know, at that time her daughter was about 16 and she came in the room and, you know, she's just dealing with life the way everybody, I mean, but that's what's great about her music. It's about the fundamentals of life, you know. She was really a big deal to me, but then when she wanted to become a singer, songwriter, I think it's because James Taylor had really kind of shown everyone, and they were friends, you know, just she really saw that you could actually be the person who wrote the song, singing the song, and that was, there was an added interest there. And I really believe that people should sing their own songs. I used to sing Warren Zevon's songs before I got them recorded because I wanted people to hear the song. So I would sing in Mohammed's Radio, or I'd sing Werewolves of London. And my record company saying, well, Werewolves of London, you're going to record that, right? I go, no, 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 I want Warren to record that. You know, the real deal.
Jackson Brown. This song, My Cleveland Heart, is on his new album, Downhill from Everywhere.
I'm gonna make a few changes right away. The way I lead and the way I fall. The way I need somebody else's eyes to see me. The way I need anyone at all. But I expect the real changes to start when I finally get my
If you love conversations with pioneering singer-songwriters, be sure to check out my interview with Carly Simon. A little over 50 years ago, a show at the Troubadour changed her life.
Three of us rehearsed in New York for 3 days, and then we went out to L.A., and by that time I had...
Opened for Cat Stevens.
Opened for Cat Stevens April 6th, 1971.
April 6th?
Yes.
And that changed things for you?
That was a convincing night. We played two shows every night and four shows on the weekend. I met all kinds of people. It was like the lights
were
shining
it.
On me. I couldn't say no at that point. And even though I was suffering tremendous stage fright, I had various things that tricked me out of being afraid.
Hear the rest of my talk with Carly Simon at hearsthething.org. After the break, Jackson Brown talks about collaborating with a new generation of singer-songwriters like Phoebe Bridgers.
I've been walking that broken line between the way life is and the way it seems.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
Tracing our steps from the beginning until they vanished into the air. Trying to understand how our lives had led us there. Looking hard into your eyes, there was nobody I'd ever known. Such an empty surprise.
This song, Late for the Sky, is from Jackson Brown's third studio album of the same name, released in 1974. Jackson Brown is on tour with James Taylor this summer. The pandemic delayed the release of his latest album and tour. Jackson Brown contracted COVID in March of 2020.
I got it at a show that was being done. We were being very careful, trying to distance and elbow bump and sanitize.
And you got it?
And I got it.
How did you feel? What was it like?
It wasn't a very bad case. You know, I didn't have any problem breathing, and I felt well again in a couple of weeks. So, and I could tell I was going to get better. I just didn't get that sick.
And your son got it too, correct?
Yeah. I came back from New York, and we got together, and of course, my son and I hugged, and, you know.
Yeah, can't be helped.
But that's when everything shut down, and here we are still trying to get it back up and running, and it looks good now.
One of the songs on your new album is called My Cleveland Heart, and I wanted you to talk about that, about what was the genesis of that song.
Well, I happened to be in Cleveland and driving by a building. I said, "What's that?" And they said, "That's Cleveland Heart." And I said, "What's Cleveland Heart?" And they said, "Well, that's where they make the artificial hearts." And I thought, oh, I could use one of those.
Why do you feel that way?
This one.
You need an artificial heart?
Yeah, just like one that doesn't break. They don't ache. You know, they don't make mistakes.
Right.
And they're not that much to the song, but it was really fun to make a video of me getting this artificial heart. And it's enormous, too. It looks made out of motorcycle parts and sort of put this thing in my chest. It's like, ooh, am I... But it's satirical and surreal, too. And it sort of made a fun video because the doctors that are operating on me, the actual players in my band, I mean, and then begin to play. The metaphors are really abundant there, you know. I mean, they save my life every night. They save my life on stage. And in a way, they do, like, do a sort of heart transplant.
How did Phoebe Bridgers get to become the person that's going to eat your heart?
Well, that was just that was very spontaneous. We didn't plan the video for her Eat My Heart. It's just the way that happened was, I know Phoebe and I'm a huge fan of hers. And as a matter of fact, one of the reasons I picked that director was that she'd worked with Phoebe and I liked the video that they made. And I had just been working with her because she invited me to sing on her song Kyoto, an acoustic version of that. And she invited me to sing on it. So I think somebody said, oh, you know, Phoebe could be one of the nurses in this video, in your surgery. And I said, oh, yeah, great. Let's ask her. And she was game. So once I knew that she was going to be a nurse, I thought, you know, maybe, yeah, when they take my heart out, maybe they can, and it's gory, this, you know, maybe they can hand it to her and she could receive my heart. And then it was somebody else who knows her quite well who said, yeah, and she eats it. It was her producer, Tony Berg, who said, they're going to hand her the heart and then she's off screen, but then they're going to go back to showing her just standing off to one side with my heart. And I thought, that's not real. They wouldn't do that, right? And I was discussing with Tony and he said, yeah, she eats it. Or she takes a bite, you know. And apparently it's like, you know, everybody thinks it's really kind of apropos of who Phoebe is. Her songs are so dark. I know, one of the things I love about it, about her music, you know. And so that's how that happened. And of course, that director is so great, her use of light and location.
What is that director's name?
Her name is Alyssa Torvinen.
Uh-huh.
She also did a great video with Pink.
But the album, the song is called Cleveland Heart, but the album itself is called Downhill from Everywhere.
Yeah.
And what was the genesis of that? Are we downhill now from everywhere?
Well, the ocean is downhill from everywhere. And everything in the song is something that winds up in the ocean. Plastic. It's actually about plastic, that song.
Oh, yeah. I remember when I lived in L.A., and of course you'd see all the storm drains. It said, you know, drains to the ocean.
Right.
And I never forget... The LA Weekly talked about how 20-year veteran lifeguards in the beach department there in Venice were contracting kidney cancer from all of the pollutants in the bay.
Right.
I worked with Heal the Bay, the Bologna wetlands. They were constantly breaching and having these blowouts and during storms and all kinds of untreated sewage going into the bay. And
yeah, and when it rains in LA, you got to stay out of the water because the runoff into the,
horrible water
makes it absolutely toxic.
Yeah. You know? What I wanted to get to is your activism. I just recently, they closed the Indian Point reactor here, and I've worked to shut down utility reactors for probably right around 25 years now with disparate groups.
Wow.
And you, of course, had a very, very serious relationship with the anti-nuclear movement. I believe that Three Mile Island happened in March of 79. You helped form Muse that same year, correct?
Yeah.
And then you perform at the No Nukes concert in September of that same year, correct?
Yeah, yeah. We had formed Muse and we're planning that concert before Three Mile Island melted down and before the release of that pivotal movie, China Syndrome,
right,
that really sort of went into the problems and in a feature film. So all that happened all at once, and that gave a lot of currency and a lot of emphasis.
At what point in your life did you decide to take that on? You're writing songs, things start to go well, David Geffen's representing you. When did you decide you wanted to get active publicly?
You know, I was raised in the 60s, and so I was a member of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, and I'd take part in, you know, demonstrations. I didn't really have songs about these things, you know. There were plenty of movement songs. Actually, a lot of the songs that I knew in the civil rights era were actually from the labor movement in the 30s. So there's a lot in the folk music that has a kind of activism component, or it has a social consciousness component. And particularly the early songs that Bob Dylan did. So there was a strong call to be involved and to do things that would move society in the right direction. And I think that we, like so many people, we assume that that was always happening and that it was always going to happen and that the arc of justice and so on and all that was, it was just an assured thing that we were moving forward until, you know, about 5 years ago.
You didn't worry that it was going to hurt your career?
No, no. And I didn't really believe that it did, although I think when you start writing songs about it, that's the question, whether or not people want to hear anti-war songs or they want to hear songs about nuclear power. It's like, if people are averse to hearing, you know, about society's problems, they're not going to want to hear it in a song. I'm a songwriter. I talk about life. You know, you got to talk about what's happening in the real world. You can't just barricade yourself off in this entertainment land. Like, what's going on was like a huge surprise to everybody. At the height of the Vietnam War, that, you know, a singer like Marvin Gaye would come out with a song that was considered a protest song. Barry Gordy didn't want to release it. But it was too good. It was too true to be denied. And I think that, for that matter, John Lennon also, you know, in the height of the Beatles, you know, as they broke up, he began singing songs about his personal development. I mean, you know, he famously went through the primal scream therapy and stuff, but he began writing songs like, "Mother, you had me, but I didn't have you. You know, Father, you left me, but I never left you." That was so powerful. That's what songwriting was about for me. And I mean, Bob Dylan was, you know, right at that sort of crux of every one of these moments when things doubled down and people were singing about what was really going on in their life and what was really going on in the world. And all those people remind you is that this music has been made all along. I mean, there's songs, Woody Guthrie songs and Bob Dylan songs and Pete Seeger songs, Joan Baez. This is a big part of what music has always been. And it was only in Hollywood that you were sort of told, don't try to make any political points here. Maybe it's New York too. Maybe it's simply the hierarchy, the financial hierarchy of the country. You know, doesn't want anybody waking up.
Singer, songwriter, and activist Jackson Brown. When we return, Jackson Brown talks about the songs that still move him to tears.
Awake again, I can't pretend. And I know I'm alone.
Follow Here's the Thing on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, leave us a review. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
65, I was 17, and up on one. I don't know where I'm running now, I'm just running on. Running on empty, running on. Running wild, running into the sun, but I'm running behind.
Running on Empty is the title track to Jackson Brown's 1977 live album, recorded at the Meriwether Post Pavilion in Columbia, Maryland. Brown was part of LA's Laurel Canyon music scene in the 1970s. Musicians like Joni Mitchell, Bonnie Raitt, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and the Eagles often dropped by each other's houses to play music together. Brown still marvels at how he was able to meet some of his heroes.
From the beginning, I met people that I really had a huge admiration for. Like David Crosby, you know, sang on my first album. I mean, he sort of, it's almost like being knighted or something, you know. he gave me the accolade of being, of singing harmony on four or five of my songs. And I really learned so much of how to work, how to get what I get in the studio from him. Now, there was a concert I did one time where Crosby, Stills, and Nash were there, but Neil wasn't there. And I was on stage. There's a picture of me with Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Brown. It's like, it was like, I thought, well, that's wild, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a long time ago. But I got to say, the people that I admire the most are people I'm still very shy about and don't even know how to overcome that, my admiration, enough to be really, really good friends with. I mean, I can't quite get over it. You know, what they mean to me and what the music meant to me.
Springsteen inducted you into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm.
Is he a friend of yours and someone you admire?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, and he, and we met at a gig that we were both doing at Villanova. And he actually, he was opening for me, and I'd never seen him. I'd met him, we already knew each other because he came and did a guest set when I was playing acoustically at this club called The Main Point in Philadelphia. And so we knew each other, and I knew his music, and saw me that I was doing this gig with Bruce, and that he was, you know, that I was, he said, "You're what? You were going to follow Bruce? Oh, I don't know. I don't think you should do that." It really bothered me, pissed me off. I said, "What do you mean? I'm going to like," but then I saw this show, and it was really, I mean, I saw what he was doing, and it was just astounding. he's a thing unto himself, and he amplified so much of what he saw in rock and roll to a degree to almost make it into another art form. But I got to say, I feel quite apart from all of that. I mean, I try to learn from everything that I love. I try to take it in and learn part of it or how it applies to what I want to do. But I feel like what I do is quite different. I mean, I'm always put together with the Eagles, but when I think about it, we really wrote about very different things. And for that matter, like Take It Easy is a very, you know, it's a song that I wrote with Glenn Frey. And so I'm linked in that way forever, and I'm very happy about it. But it wouldn't have been that song if Glenn Frey had not done what he did. He wrote about what he writes about. I write about what I write about. And like standing on the corner in Winslow, Arizona, I see an Indian guy. I see a tall Indian guy with a white cowboy hat, you know, turquoise shirt, standing on the corner. And I probably would have written about him. And of course, Glenn.
Instead, you wrote about there's a girl, my lord, in a flatbed Ford.
Yeah, slowing down to look at me.
Slowing down, you know, to take a look at me.
That's pure Glenn Frey. That's like, that, you know.
Well, I've always said, you musicians have this beautiful reality. Music is so much more powerful than film and television because you can consume it anywhere, in the shower, while you're having sex, while you're jogging, while you're in the car. Music is in our lives in a way that you don't have to make that kind of appointment visually with movies and TV. And how beautiful for you that you can just sit down and write. And you can just sit down and play, and it's all self-generated. It's you. It comes from you.
Yeah.
And the film business, it's so collaborative. But who's one example or more of someone you always dreamed of working with and you wish you'd been able to work with them, that you just love their music from any generation?
Oh, God. There are so many. Singing with Phoebe Bridgers was a big deal for me because I love somebody's. I mean, maybe I'd like to do something with Lucinda Williams, you know? She's one of my favorites, and I don't know how she does what she does. It's just so mysterious to me that I can't figure out how I bring that bring that about. I guess you'd have to write a song together or something. So being invited, it's almost the necessary component for me. So who do I want to call me up and invite to sing with them or write a song with? Lucinda would be great. I love women writers, you know, women songwriters. I Sean Colvin, but I don't think of it like that. I got to play with some wonderful musicians just last weekend. We did a live stream event for an organization called Plastic Pollution Coalition, and the lineup, it was everybody sang one song by themselves, then one song with somebody else, but it was Ben Harper, Keb Mo, Mandy Moore, Taylor Goldsmith, and Inara George, who's my goddaughter, but it's also who's like the singer in the great group The Bird and the Bee, and she's been in a bunch of bands, and is an artist in her own right, but also a group called the Watkins Family Hour, which are Sarah and Sean Watkins, who I've played with before, so I can't like name them, but I just to show you, I mean, when stuff happens, it happens by accident. It's almost got to be an accident. Like I told you, I can't call people and say, I want to write a song with you. Matter of fact, some of those people have invited me to write a song with them, and I don't even know that I can accept that offer, you know? Like
I want to see that phone call. I want to see you at your house and someone you love and admire calls because you know something, man? It's just time has come. The time has come for you and I to just do this, man. We got to do this song. We talked about it in London. We talked about it in Rio. I saw you again at the airport in Miami and we talked about it. And now the time has come for us to do that song. And you're like, I'm going to call you back. I'll call you back tomorrow.
I have tremendous performance anxiety.
You still do?
Look, Carole King asked me to, get together and write a song. She came over to my house and we spent the afternoon, I made a tape of the thing, you know, and we started hit on an idea there. And that was like 30 years ago. I'm still working on that song. I always tell them, look, I'm the slowest writer you ever, you know.
We're going to say that. Thank you for listening to my interview with Jackson Brown, the slowest writer in rock and roll history. Is there a song, because your songs are so emotional, some of them, they're very powerful emotionally. Mm. And is there a song where when you play it, it still moves you?
Well, honestly, this will sound like bragging, but that's what they do to me. Not every song is that kind of a song, but I mean, there are a number of songs that do that to me. And that's what I learned going out solo acoustic was that's the only business I have being there is that this song still move me and it's real because you're pretty much naked when you're up there with just by yourself. But I would say that there was a song on my recent record that I was having trouble finishing because I kept crying as I was trying to, I mean, they weren't even my lines. I was collaborating with a guy on the song called Love is Love. It's a song that I wrote in Haiti, and we were talking about this guy who is a priest that has built schools and hospitals in Haiti, and he rides around on a motorcycle, and he's in this song. And I say, Rick rides a motorbike through the worst slums of the city. And my friend said, well, what would you say about Father Rick? And he says, well, the father and the doctor to the poorest of the poor. And for some reason, that just messed me up. Because I've seen the work that he's done, and I've seen the people that he helps and ministers to, and it does now. It gives me chills to say those words, and I didn't write them. That my collaborator David Bell wrote those words. But every time I'd sing that, I mean, it had, and I began laughing about it too. After this, but I say, I'm trying to finish the song, but this song has like a very big sob factor in it. I mean, it's like messing me up to say these lines. There was a line in Late for the Sky that did that same thing when I wrote it. But by the time it's a song, it doesn't make me cry. But you know who does that? Like Bonnie Raitt sings Love Has No Pride, and she would cry real tears all through the song. She like just, everybody cried. I mean, it's like that she was getting through it was kind of a miracle, but that just happens to her when she sings that song. And I don't know how she can sing and cry, but she did. Also, when we were at the Hall of Fame anniversary show and Crosby, Stills, and Nash hosted Bonnie and hosted me and hosted James Taylor, she sang Love Has No Pride with David and Graham, and she did it again. She just brings it to that place where that song, she inhabits that song. It's so real that, I mean, she just comes to tears and brings so many other people to tears too.
You know what song you sing that is so moving to me? I mean, I'm not going to say it's the most beautiful song because you have a lot of beautiful songs, but I love Linda Paloma. That's a beautiful song.
Wonderful. Thank you.
What was the inspiration for that song?
Well, I wrote that for my wife and my first wife, and we spent the whole first month we knew each other in Mexican restaurants listening to mariachi music and drinking. They would always play her this song, Cucuru Cucu La Paloma. So I wanted to write her a Paloma song, you know? And they would really sing to her. She was really beautiful. And she knew that song, but when I wrote it, of course, it was sometime after that. But it was a tribute to her, really. That's how that song came about.
Well, listen, I'm glad you're healthy. Best of luck on the tour with James Taylor, although you don't need luck when it's the two of you. It sounds like a lock to me. It'll be great. And thank you so much for doing this with us.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Jackson Brown. This is Linda Paloma from his fourth album, The Pretender. I'm Alec Baldwin. Here's the Thing is brought to you by iHeart Radio.
At the moment the music began and you heard the guitar player starting to sing, you were filled with the beauty that ran through it, you were imagining. Dreaming of scenes from those songs of love, I was the music that played in your